888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to tonight's show at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. I'm Michael Shaw, the host for this evening. Tonight we're going to have two very interesting yet diverse shows. In our first hour, we're going to talk about the American jury. Are we performing? Now, the real question here is, do jurors have a role in determining the legitimacy of law? Our guest tonight, Elo Jones, is going to explain to us what jury nullification is all about. In our second hour, we're going to talk about the return of sustainable transportation scam to Santa Cruz. Wyatt Hull, UCSC, that's University of California Santa Cruz student, discusses the Santa Cruz County tax collector Fred Keeley's transportation funding meeting, which was held on campus today. Despite the fact that Santa Cruzans have rejected a transportation measure called Measure J last year, which was a huge sustainable transportation bond, the local sustainability change agents have regrouped and are back with a new consensus program. If you're a regular listener, you know what consensus means, to skirt the will of the voters. The patterns revealed in the meetings of this type were important to citizens here in Santa Cruz, and so the patterns can be recognized by citizens across the country when the same scam hits your town. But right now, let's move on with our guest for this hour, Elo Jones.
Michael, good evening. I'm so happy to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's nice to have you way up in the northern reaches of Montana.
Yes, true. where it's actually been very warm today, but it's cooler this evening. Before we get into talking, we have a lot to talk about. I'd like to, if I may, give out our call, our number people can call for free information, as well as our website URL, just so people will have that on hand. So if people have a pencil, we'll do this again later in the show, I hope. But
certainly,
let me give that now, just so we have that out of the way, if you don't mind.
Please do.
Our website is www.fija, for Fully Informed Jury Association, that's fija.org, for organization, O-R-G. And our free call-in number, if you call this number, we will send you a free first-class mailing, a packet of information. We won't give your name or your address to anybody else, by the way. We'll keep it here in a file, and I will guard it, and we never violate anyone's privacy when they call in. Our number to call is 1-800-TELJURY. That's TEL with one L, J-U-R-Y. In numbers, for those of you who, like me, hate to figure out which number goes with which letter on your phone pad, it's 1-800-835-5879. Please call, get our information kit, find out about your power and your authority, and also your duty to the defendant when you serve on a jury.
Well, thank you very much. That's good information. And people who don't understand or have not heard of jury nullification are going to find this hour very revealing. So let's begin. I know myself, and having gone to law school, the idea of jury nullification was something that was never discussed in any form of school, and it wasn't till much later as an adult that I became aware at all that the concept existed.
Isn't that sad that even though this is a cornerstone of legal tradition going back to the Magna Carta, when they instituted juries of one's peers, so that no matter what laws he had, he couldn't get away with it.
We'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz.
Great.
We're back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz while some stations take a jury break, and we're going to continue with our guest, Elo Jones, and we're talking about jury nullification. Now, for the uninformed, give a basic definition so that we know what this this next hour is going to be about.
Okay, because I think it's really important people understand jury nullification. When juries nullify in a case, they hold the law as naught. That doesn't mean that they are throwing the law out, but in this particular case, In this specific instance, they may think the law is being misapplied. They may think the law is unfair for this person. They may actually think it is a bad law, but since they're only sitting on this one case, they can only hold the law as not in this one case. It is the power, the final veto power people have over laws made by our government. If the government makes laws we don't like, and our government could be a king or a democracy or a republic or anything, but if the government makes laws that we, the people, do not like, that take away our rights, that are repressive or tyrannical, then the jury is there fundamentally. This is really the role of the jury, Michael. The jury is there to protect the rights of the defendant against the government. So we're talking, as you can see, mostly about criminal cases here. And any one juror can simply say, I do not think that there is good and sufficient reason to find this person guilty. And we are all required, by the way, when we serve on a jury, to vote our conscience. You should always vote your conscience when you serve on a jury. Don't be swayed because the judge says, if you don't vote the way I think you should, you'll be punished, or because some other juror says, oh, let's go ahead and find him guilty because I want to be home for lunch, or another juror says, well, if we find this kid guilty, he's probably only going to get probation, so it doesn't really matter if we find him guilty. Let's just find him guilty and everybody will be happy and go home. Never cave in. You could be ruining someone's life. So that's what jury nullification is in a nutshell. There are a lot of instances of jury nullification, which I hope we'll have time to talk about.
Well, perhaps we can talk about one, that the prohibition made by constitutional amendment in this country back in the 19-teens and eventually went away. Jury nullification had a role in its dissipation, did it not?
Very, very strong role, and we're not told about this because basically, as you said, you went to law school and they didn't tell you about jury nullification. This is a hidden right. They don't want people to know that we have this right. But of course we do, because we have all rights we did not give agency to the government to exercise for us, and we certainly didn't give them the agency to exercise our conscience. But anyway, during Prohibition, they kept bringing these guys to trial, these people to trial for...
Hold that thought for just
whatever,
a moment.
You know,
we're going to come right back.
Juries refused to find them guilty.
Well, that begins to deliver the message. If jurors are aware of their rights and really obligations as jurors to not look only at the facts of a case, but to look at the law behind the case, and if the law is offending them, I think is what you're telling us,
yes,
is that the jury has a duty to speak out about the law, and that's what happened, and that's what really had played a major role in killing prohibition in this country.
Yes, and the jury spoke out by refusing to convict. Many, many, many juries spoke out about how they felt the law was a bad law, and they refused to convict. I'd like to go back a little bit earlier than that and talk about some of the fundamental foundations of jury nullification in this country and why we have that right. When the country was founded, and by the way, by speaking out, we're saying that they do that by rendering a not guilty verdict. It doesn't mean you stand up in court and say, I don't like this, I'm, you know, going to be upset about it. You have to do this as a member of the jury in the jury deliberation room.
Okay.
Other than that, you have no right to scoff at the laws, as far as I'm concerned. You change them by nullifying them or getting them off the books in some way or another when you're sitting in the jury room. You don't just stand up as a member of the jury and deliver a speech to the judge. Not that that might be always out of place. But early in our history, when William Penn, who founded Pennsylvania, was still in London, and as you probably know, William Penn was a Quaker, he and some other fellows were trying to hold a Quaker meeting, and the king had ordered their church locked because it was not the Church of England and therefore it was not a legal religion. So these fellows were outside on the sidewalk preaching, and the king's soldiers came and arrested them. They were taken to court, and the jury refused to find them guilty of breaking the law because they thought it was a silly law. Now, this is when a very important precedent was reaffirmed, not established, but reaffirmed, or a very important fact about jurors, and that is that jurors cannot be punished for their verdict. The judge was so angry in this case that the jurors would not find William Penn guilty that he threw the jury into prison without food and, I think, without heat, and kept them there for a few days, and they finally got a writ of habeas corpus and they were freed. And the high court handed down a decision and said juries cannot be punished. No juror, not one juror, can be punished for their verdict. That came down to us. Of course, William Penn later came to the United, what was in the colonies, and it's out of Pennsylvania. And that tradition, and there are many other cases which support this, and if people go to our website, again, that's fija.org, there's all kinds of quotes and citations. But this tradition that the juries have absolute authority to nullify or to veto or to ignore bad laws or bad application of laws comes down to us from these traditions going back to the Magna Carta through the William Penn trial and other trials where juries simply refused to convict when they felt it was a bad law or a misapplied law.
Wow. Well, if the trial by jury is in the Bill of Rights, does that imply that there's a political role here for a jury?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact. There's a strong political role, and we touched on it a little bit earlier, and that is if juries across the country consistently refuse to find people guilty and therefore make it impossible to enforce bad laws or to enforce laws that are misapplied or mostly laws that are a usurpation of the rights that we retained as citizens when we made the contract with our government. If jurors refuse to find people guilty or apply those laws, that sends a very clear political message back to the framers of the laws and back through the courts and back even to the police who would arrest people, that there's no use doing this. Mr. Prosecutor, Mr. Policeman, Mr. Judge, well, whoever, there's no use bringing people to trial under this law because the juries will refuse to find them guilty. And that's exactly, of course, what happened during Prohibition when juries helped to cause the repeal of Prohibition. So the political role is incredibly strong here. It's also the final check and balance, I should say, the final peaceful check and balance on government, because juries can protect fellow citizens from overly zealous or overly ambitious court officials by simply refusing to find people guilty. So it's highly political. And that's one reason courts do not like for people to know their rights and their authority as jurors.
Well, I've never served on a jury myself, but I have been called to federal court for a jury pool. It was very clear from the judge in San Jose, the federal judge, who was taking care of this potential jury pool. He made it very clear that the prospective juror's role was to evaluate the truth or falsity of the evidence that, and I'll never forget, he said, it is the judge who determines and tells you what the law is. Your job is to apply the law, to apply the facts to the law that you're given. He was very, very defensive about that limitation on the juror's role.
He lied to you. Of course. And I just finished a commentary on that, which is, on our website at fija.org. Judges often lie, and sometimes they may have gone to law school and made it this far in life, and they don't actually know the truth. But more often than not, they simply do not want to recognize the supreme authority in the courtroom when there is a jury constituted, and that is the jury. The verdict of a jury, if the jury votes not guilty, there's no appeal. The jury can protect people by finding them not guilty.
You know, it seems to me that this has a role not only in criminal cases, though. As you may or may not be aware, our focus here at Freedom 21 is the erosion of property rights in this country and the conversion of property law from free enterprise to public-private partnership, where if you're not a buddy with government, well, you don't have property rights. You've got to gain your property rights through the government. And so we're going to see in this state, in states around the country, increasing environmental excuses and other justifications for stripping people of their property rights.
Okay, just plain-out takings in many cases, when somebody else would give them a better tax revenue base.
Exactly.
And Amendment 7 may be, if it isn't, it's certainly one of the most important parts of our Constitution, and I'm sure you know what it says. May I read it?
Yes.
Amendment 7 says, in suits of common law, which means not criminal cases, in suits at common law where the value of controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined by any court in the United States and according to the rules of the common law. And, Michael, the gravity of this amendment, were it followed and were it recognized for what it's supposed to be, and forget the fact that, you know, government has caused incredible inflation and $20 doesn't mean much anymore. But it suits in common law, the kind of suits you're talking about. Everyone, according to our Constitution, our contract with government, everyone has a right to a trial by jury if the suit exceeds $20. That's never been amended. And so if someone wants to take your property, you have a right to ask for a jury trial. And I'm hoping that before you have had to come to the point where you need a jury trial, you've had time to educate everybody in your community who is your jury pool, and you, the jurors will be drawn from there, and they understand their obligation to you in this case and that they must protect you and your property rights. And the main reason they must do that is not out of any deep moral sense, but because in doing so, they also are protecting themselves.
Well, that's a huge statement. I find it particularly huge. I know that very recently we had a Superior Court judge in this county rule exactly opposite to that, in that they held that you didn't even get to go to a Superior Court or any other court for civil misdemeanors, is what the county calls them, dealing with property issues, for thousands of dollars. In other words, you can get an administrative fine through the planning department for land use policies.
Oh, you can get it for just not taking your garbage out on time.
Yeah, without any kind of jury review.
Without due process.
Yeah, so they've even shortcutted the jury nullification process by prohibiting people even to be able to get to a court of their peers.
Yes.
And have the jury
render. And of course, that's against the law, because the superior law in this land is the Constitution. And it's against the Constitution, isn't it?
Well, that seems to be less consequence in this country.
Right, but that's why we have to get other people to understand their role as a jury. Again, the primary role of a juror is to protect people from the usurpation of rights and the tyranny of government, because any government, and it doesn't have to be ours, any government in the world, constituted so that it can use force, will take away as much as it can from the citizens under that government.
Hmm.
It may take them 50 years, it may take them 500, but they will do that. And that's why our founders were brilliant in giving us trial by jury in so many ways. Did you know that trial by jury is mentioned 4 times in the Constitution?
No,
I did
not. How
significant it was. But we, because people don't understand their role in this, that when they render a verdict, in whether it's in a civil or a criminal case, not only are they either protecting society or protecting the individual if that person doesn't need to be, you know, taken out of society, but they're also rendering a vote about the law that's being presented to them. And it doesn't matter what any judge says. We all have the same brain as the judge. We can all think. We can all reason. We all have our own conscience. We must consider what we're being told in the courtroom. We must be incredibly skeptical toward the judges, the police, and the prosecutors these days. And why is that so? That's because they're being paid by the same government that is trying to strip us of our rights and take away our property and take away our lives, put us in prison, and sell our property to the highest tax bidder. So be very skeptical, because where are they? Who's paying them? This is the elegant construction of a jury. It's 12 people. I won't say they're entirely objective, but they're largely disinterested in any particular case for which they're called. And they are there to render justice. Justice does not happen through the police, the lawyers, or the judges anymore. Justice must happen through the jury.
Well, when we come back here in a few moments, we're going to discuss how it is that jurors have been dissuaded from their traditional role of the protectors of liberty.
Great.
We'll be right back at Freedom 21. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio with our special guest, Elo Jones, and we're talking about jury nullification, a concept that, gee, it's my experience, that very few people have ever heard the term. You say jury nullification, they wouldn't even understand that you're talking a legal concept, much less a concept that conveys the kind of power to a jury that that you're talking about.
Do you know anything about the Ed Rosenthal case in California?
No.
Ed Rosenthal, and I don't want to digress too much, but I want to make a point. Ed Rosenthal was growing medical marijuana under license from the city of Oakland for medical marijuana patients. The
yes.
federal government raided the licensed facility, charged Ed with all kinds of drug counts. The defense, Ed, in this case, was not allowed to present a lot of evidence. In fact, the jury couldn't even know why he was growing marijuana or for whom, because the federal judge ruled it irrelevant. And the jury was basically told that they had to just find him guilty if the facts proved that he was guilty of breaking the law as it was written. Silly law, nonetheless. One of the jurors, during deliberations, actually called a friend who was an attorney and said, I really feel like we shouldn't be finding... Well, I'm not quite sure what she said, but the gist of it was the attorney said, you have to follow the judge's instructions or you can get into trouble. And so she voted guilty.
My.
Even that attorney did not know jurors cannot be punished for their verdict. Unless they've taken a bribe from someone, of course, or something like that, then they
right.
should, you know, then of course they should be punished because they're thwarting justice.
But in voting their conscience, they cannot be.
No, they cannot be, and people don't know this. And so in the Ed Rosenthal case, to come back around, the jury was there to protect him. And on appeal, Ed won because the higher court judge said juries should never feel intimidated during deliberations. They should never feel that there anything they want to discuss or their verdict can get them punished or in any trouble, because it cannot. And so when judges tell you, you must follow the law, you've taken an oath, you must do this, you must do that, you don't need to say this to them, but just in your own mind, take a mental reservation and go into the jury room knowing that you're going to face your decision on your own sense of right and wrong. That's why we have juries. And there is no one in this country, other than the people who are making a living doing so, there is no one in this country who believes that taking private land from people or limiting how people can use their own private property is a just and reasonable thing to do. The only people who believe that that's a good thing to do are the government agents or people who are basically believe that don't believe in private property or they don't understand the concept. Because, you know, the word property was only left out of our Declaration of Independence and other documents because everybody assumed that we all knew that, as everyone back then assumed everybody knew that juries had to judge both the law and the facts in any case, and that their primary role was to protect the defendant from the government, because they had just come out from under a king who would try people without a jury and, you know, for under crazy laws, like, you know, you said something bad about one of my royal appointed governors, therefore you will go to the gallows. Well, they understood what the jury had to do. The jury had to protect its fellow citizens from government tyranny. And that's what we must start doing it. Well, we have to continue doing it today.
Now, what does a juror do, someone sitting in a jury box, being selected or rejected as a juror? I mean, if you came out and said, I believe in jury nullification, that's probably the fastest way to be taken off.
I might even dismiss the whole jury pool as tainted and start all over again.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, that's happened.
My.
Because the judge, the prosecutor, even the defense attorneys, they don't want to give up their power. They don't want knowledgeable, reasoning jurors. They want people who will do what they're told and think what they're told to think and follow the dictates of the court.
Is awareness of jury nullification on the rise?
Yes, it is, I'm happy to say.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, I think FIJA, having been around for 16 years, and the unceasing efforts of the two founders, Larry Dodge and Don Doig, has had a lot to do with that. And also, as more jurors, more citizens, more people on the streets become aware of their authority as jurors, and they tell other people, because they suddenly see that maybe there is a way to control government. Maybe there is a way to get back a handle on our own rights and to protect them without doing the last thing we would do, of course, because I'm sure you know about the four boxes we have to protect our liberties.
No, tell me about those.
Oh, okay. Well, this is an old quote, and it's a good quote. We have four boxes to protect our liberties in this country, and they were all built into our Constitution. The first is the ballot box, basically, which means that you get to vote on things. The second is the soapbox. This is freedom of speech. The first is our franchise to vote. The second, freedom of speech, the soapbox, which means you and I can have this conversation this evening.
Right.
And other people can talk about other things, even though we know in many instances now we're beginning to lose our soapbox. The third box we have to protect our rights is the jury box, because we can refuse to enforce bad laws being brought in under prosecution against otherwise innocent, unharmful, nonviolent, non-criminal people. And the last box we have, of course, to which we hope we will not have to go, is the cartridge box. And that's protected. That right was protected under the Constitution because they had just come out from winning a war against the greatest power on earth because they were armed. And I'm sure you know enough of the history of colonial America and the Revolution to know that at Lexington and Concord, those battles were because government, British government soldiers were trying to take weapons away from colonialists so that they could no longer resist. And so our founder said, oh wait, we are going to always be able to arm ourselves and resist the tyranny of government, just in case. So we're trying to remedy the situations that we see now. We're trying to stop the usurpation, reverse the erosion of the free exercise of our rights. You have your rights as a human, but you can lose the free exercise of those rights. We're trying to reverse that erosion by teaching people to stop it at the jury box.
And who is it that opposes this concept that you talk about, and particularly the third of these four boxes, the jury box?
Well, I think the same people who oppose the other boxes, don't you? People that don't want people to know that they have rights. People who would like organizations and institutions who want us to be obedient,
compliant,
pliable, malleable,
yes.
Sheepish, defenseless, ignorant, and in the dark.
Well, so I wish you'd stop talking about the school system like that, you know.
Pardon?
I said, I wish you'd stop talking about the school system like that.
We could have a whole discussion about that. We just finished a brochure on how juries can protect Second Amendment rights, and I gave it to about 20 people to read, and two of them came back at me a couple days later and said, you must write something on how juries can protect homeschoolers. And they brought me all these legal documents. I have a stack on the corner of my desk here now because they're right. We have to write something on how, you know, parents' rights and children's rights to not go to public schools. And so we're going to be working on that one next. And so we will publish these brochures. These are very focused brochures, of course, and try to get them out to everybody who has these specific interests so that they can share the knowledge with other people. And they will understand that how we protect ourselves from government is through the jury. And certainly how we can protect ourselves. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of at loss on how you protect yourselves from government schools other than not having your children there.
True. Although you're a victim of a government school, even if your children don't go there,
because
our society is run by the intellectual product that comes out of our schools.
And to say that they are anything less than indoctrination camps is to do them too much credit, because they are indoctrination camps.
Right.
And I hear stories. I have several people who work for me, all of whom are homeschoolers, because I find them to be the brightest, most initiative-taking, and intelligent people around, and many of them are also homeschooled. Some of them are fairly young, and they bring back these horror stories about what's going on in public schools, where their children are being taught that voting is not a right but a privilege.
Yes.
And that it's not all of these things that we know are human rights are not rights. The being able to defend your life. If you have the right to life, of course you have the right to defend it. But the children are being taught that no. That's why, you know, that used to be true, but now we have government to protect us, so we don't need to be able to defend our own lives anymore.
We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. We're back for our second half hour with Elo Jones discussing the issue of jury nullification, which in short says that a jury can nullify the law that's being applied to a civil or a criminal a litigant.
Yes, in a specific case only where that jury is seated, of course. It doesn't nullify the law completely, even though enough nullifications or enough not guilty verdicts send a very strong message back to the people who are making these laws. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how juries protect property rights, because we all know now that the wisdom being handed down from on high, and I often say on low, tongue-in-cheek, but the wisdom coming up from on low these days is that government knows far better than any individual what should be done with that individual's property.
You're seeing that even in Montana, huh?
Oh, we see that. Of course we see that in Montana.
Yes.
And that government knows far better than anybody how that property should be used, managed, cared for, and how much taxes should be put on that property. So you might have a vacant piece of property with nothing on it, but if they decide that you could develop it, they may raise your taxes by a factor of 10.
And then not allow you to develop it.
Right, exactly, because you won't get past the county commissioner's planning committee or something.
Right.
And then they may do something even worse. They may decide that they need to take part of that property for some public use. Let's say they need to put in a sewage pumping station because the guy down the road was allowed to put in a really big development because his brother is a county commissioner. And he, you know, obviously funded his brother's campaign and who knows what else. And we all know that people get to keep the money left over from their campaigns when they're in politics. So suddenly they're going to condemn a piece of your property so that they can make this housing development viable for this brother of the county commissioner. Here's the tragic part of that. It would be fairly uncommon that you would be allowed to have that you would get to exercise your right to a jury trial. You would have a hearing before a group of county commissioners, all of whom have a vested interest in controlling their power. And we are talking about power here, Michael. We're talking about people who want to build a power base, enhance a power base, build a career, enhance a career, by taking your rights, whatever those rights are, whether it's the right to keep all the money you make when you work instead of giving a lot of it away in taxes, whether it's the right to control your property and how you use it or have government tell you what you can and cannot do with your own private property, whether it's your animals and whether or not you want to have ID chips put in them on your farm.
Right.
And it gets worse, doesn't it?
Yep, it's the control of your children, it's the control of your property, it's the control of your thought process.
So we need to reverse this. If the founders of this country knew what was going on these days, I know what Thomas Jefferson would say.
Well, he would have said it, that we were past...
he would have said it 100 years ago,
exactly.
Because he thought we needed a revolution every 20 years or so.
Right.
And he would say, why are you all sitting around taking this? What's wrong with you? Don't you have any spine left? But Thomas Jefferson also said something, one of the most elegant quotes I know. And he said, I consider trial by jury as the only, I believe, instrument yet imagined by man which can hold a government to the principles of its Constitution, because he understood what the jury was supposed to do. Huh. And we have largely... Of course, no one is taught this in school, are they?
No.
And I just found the quote, so let me say it correctly. I consider trial by jury as the only anchor ever yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its Constitution. And John Adams, and we all know who he was, even these days I think you learn about John Adams in school, for people who are listening, it is not only the juror's right, but his duty in that case where he has questions to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court.
My, that's a jurors need to be handed that statement by Adams. And
well,
then
we hand it out as much as we can. We have people who, we have street workers who are out there around courthouses handing this out, not just to jurors, but to anybody going into the courthouse. We have to be very careful because we don't want to be accused of jury tampering, so we have to stay off the courthouse grounds. It's interesting where free speech is no longer allowed, isn't it?
Well, you can go on college campuses and find that out.
Right, exactly, especially public schools.
True.
John Jay, who was the first Supreme Court justice, said, the jury has the right to judge both the law as well as the fact in controversy. And Alexander Hamilton said, another founding father, jurors should acquit even against the judge's instruction if in exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty, They have a clear conviction that the charge of the court is wrong.
Well, that's quite clear, and that's coming from...
These were our founders. They understood what the jury was supposed to do. And the jury still has that power. It cannot be taken. No one can take away your conscience. No one can take away your thinking ability. And for everyone listening, no one can take away the verdict that you render. And if you are the lone holdout and everybody else says, oh, let's find the kid guilty so we can all be home in time for dinner, and you know that this, if you find this person guilty, you are sentencing this person to prison. You are finding this person as a felon. Or you are taking away their property rights or their children. Who knows? You must not give in. You must be the lone holdout. You must stand strong on your conviction. That's why we have juries. If people were just there to say, okay, here's the data, and we're going to render a verdict just based on that, guilty, not guilty, a computer could do that. A judge could do that. 12 people gathered together to deliberate in good conscience and in good faith to seek justice in this case. Have a conscience, they have a mind, they each bring their own moral history, they each bring their own view of what justice is and what's fair and what isn't and what's right and what's wrong. That's why we have juries. And that's why juries must judge the law as well as the facts, because these days there are so many bad laws.
And there's going to be more every day.
It seems that way. I'm sure we're all breaking a law every second that we take a breath. And I just want to give you one more quote, and this is a fairly recent one. This is from Byron White in 1975, and he said, "The purpose of a jury is to guard against the exercise of arbitrary power, to make available the common sense judgment of the community as a hedge against the overzealous or mistaken prosecutor, and in preference to the professional or perhaps overconditioned or biased response of a judge."
Wow.
How about that?
And that's a recent
1975
Supreme Court,
Byron White. Yes.
Yeah.
And sometimes, let's just a brief window into the history. Sometimes in this country, since it was founded, or since we were here and during colonial times, even when people have refused to convict people during the Salem witch trials, juries in several cases in a row, they simply refused to find anybody else guilty, and they finally gave up having witch trials. Then, of course, in the Whiskey Rebellion, with a special tax on corn liquor in Pennsylvania, the juries refused to find one whiskey rebel guilty. Now, one of them was found guilty, and this you'll never hear, but they had to repeal the tax because they couldn't get anybody to be found guilty. They couldn't enforce it. They came back later with another tax, but that one they had to repeal. During the Fugitive Slave Act, when it was enforced and people were being arrested for harboring fugitive slaves, especially in Quaker communities, the Quaker jurors simply refused to convict anybody under that act, whether it was a slave or somebody who had been harboring them, and they sent a clear message back that this was a dumb law and they weren't going to enforce it. And we talked a little bit about prohibition. During the Vietnam objectors and resistors in the 60s and 70s, so many juries refused to convict the Vietnam objectors and resistors that it helped to end the war. And these days, we see a lot of juries refusing to convict tax protesters and medical marijuana users.
Interesting. Now, is that because the jury actually someone on the jury actually understands jury nullification?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And when we have trials coming up where we know, and it doesn't have to be tax issues or medical marijuana, if there's any issue that comes up where we believe if the jury knew their true authority, they would refuse to convict. And we have people in the area who can do, like I'm doing with you tonight, a radio interview, write letters to the editor, hand out our literature. People buy space in newspapers. We have ads that we'll send to them so that they can put in the newspapers. People have put up billboards. They put up posters in coffee houses and restaurants around the courthouse. Amazing kinds of activism go on all across the country. And again, people will find more about that on our website at fija.org. And that reminds me, I should give our telephone number again. If you'd like to call in for a free information packet, we will send it to you. We will not share your information with anyone at all, I promise. Again, that number is 1-800-835-5879 to call for the free information packet. 1-800-TEL-JURY, TEL with one L. You can also go to our website. You can find a lot of information there. There are all kinds of things you can print off, and brochures, and they're all free. We encourage you to do that, that you print them off and share them with people. You can order materials as well. We offer a lot of different materials for all kinds of organizations. And our website, again, is FIJA, that's for Fully Informed Jury Association, .org. And for everyone who's listening, please take this information. First of all, call and get one of our information kits. Read it and understand it. Visit our website and find out more. And then please go share that information with 10 other people in your community. And here's why. And ask them to share it with 10. And here's why. Soon, some of you who are listening will be prosecuted by our government, which is becoming very power hungry. And you're going to need as many people as you can in your community, family, friends, coworkers, neighbors, club members, who may be called to serve on your jury. You're going to need for them to know about jury nullification to keep you out of prison. And I'm sure, Michael, you know that the United States has the largest proportion of its population in prison of any country in the world. More than 50% of the people in our prisons are there for nonviolent actions. They didn't hurt anybody. They are not a danger to society. They haven't done anything that harmed anyone. They are in prison for nonviolent actions because their jurors did not know, if they were lucky enough to have a jury, but then their jurors did not know that they could find them not guilty and let those people remain free to keep their job, live in their house, be with their wives and children, and go on with their life. Because just because the government makes something against the law doesn't mean it's a crime. A crime is when there's a victim. And government is not the victim. It has to be another human being whose rights you have violated. Government has no rights. We formed government to protect our rights.
You need not just a victim. You need a scienter, a knowledge, a conscious effort to violate somebody else's rights.
Yes, exactly, yes. Well, I mean, but if there is a true victim, I'm saying that the act produces a victim.
Yes.
And if somebody comes in and just says, I'm a victim because I don't like the way you plant your flowers, you haven't done anything to harm that person or their rights.
True.
Well, we want to be clear about that. No one has a right to be in a happy state of existence as far as your own property is concerned. Your property rights trump their right not to look at your flowers.
Precisely.
And jurors need to know all of this. So
well, citizens need to know it in general because we're all called upon to be jurors from time to time.
That's right, and that's why I'm saying that. Read this, find out more, tell 10 people, ask each of them to tell 10 people. Build a coalition of liberty and protection in your community so that no matter who's called for the jury, at least a couple of them will nullify and hang the jury and keep you from the government from getting its way.
We have a call from Washington State. Steve, you're with us. What's your comment or question, Steve?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Steve.
Oh, good. Sounds like you got kind of a bad connection, but anyways, I was listening to the show, and I've been called for jury 3 times in my life, and twice I've actually been pulled up into the box as they question and go through the jury selection process. And on this very subject, in both cases, the prosecuting attorneys will make a statement to the jurors. They'll say something to the effect that, now if all the facts show that this person has broken the law, you all know that you're bound to convict this person according to the law. And in one case in Santa Cruz, I'd already had kind of a run-in with the prosecuting attorney, and so he asked every other juror in the box besides me, and they all, you know, nodded their assent and said, yeah, that's right. And then he almost went on to the next subject, and I raised my hand and said, I don't agree with that. And, you know, I told him and, you know, quoted a few Supreme Court justices that the juror has the right and the responsibility to evaluate the law as well as the crime. And we ended up breaking for lunch, and one of the other jurors, you know, he was sitting next to me, he said, I wish I would have heard your testimony before I said yes, because I had to change my mind. And then when we came back in, the judge pulled out, he had a law book out, and he said, I've been reviewing what you said, and It seems like there used to be an old law that would be applicable to what you were saying, but that just doesn't really apply anymore. And then, of course, I was asked to leave the jury, and same thing up here in Washington when I got called for jury duty. It wasn't as dramatic, but I made the same points, got in an argument with the prosecuting attorney again, and got dismissed from the jury.
Steve, the prosecuting attorneys and the judge lied to you. If they didn't know the law well enough to understand the authority of the jury, they should not be serving in the capacity they serve or having a law license. And therefore, they should be disbarred. If they did know, and they didn't...
You know, I can't hear anything you guys are saying except for a couple of words here and there, so I'm going to go ahead and hang up and listen to your answer on the air.
Great.
Okay.
Should I repeat that?
Yes, do, please.
So you can hear me. Steve, both prosecuting attorneys and the judge lied to you. The law, as you stated it to them, is the true law. It is the superior law. It is the higher law. If they don't know the law and they don't understand it, then they all need to resign their positions because they have no business. They're not qualified to serve. If they do know the law and they're hiding it from you, then they are liars and dishonest, and they should not be serving in their positions. Either way, they have, by their own words and actions, disqualified themselves from the positions they hold. And we need to remember that, because we have so many people these days who think that they can lie to other people simply because they don't think we know the law. And that is why we must learn this part of the law, because people will lie to us. Many times they weren't taught this in school. Michael and I were talking about that earlier. He didn't know about this when he went to law school. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they didn't know. But if they didn't know, if they're ignorant, they shouldn't be serving in the capacity they serve, and they shouldn't have a law license. If they did know and they lied to you, then they certainly shouldn't be serving in the capacity.
I'd like to ask Steve to send an email to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz and let us know who that judge and who the prosecuting attorney here in Santa Cruz was that was responsible.
Please, and copy it to us, and you can copy it to us at aji@fija.org, or you can just go to our website and mail us through there. And again, our website is www.fija.org. We love to know about people like that. We like to expose them.
Good.
Because they're lying to us, and we're paying their salaries, folks.
Well, we're paying very important salaries to public officials.
Yes.
And when they breach the public trust, the genuine public trust for liberty and equal justice, then they've committed a heinous wrong. Because
yes.
if our pillars of justice in our communities are standing by principles of social justice and not equal justice, and are reapplying and recreating, misapplying the law in this kind of egregious fashion, then we're all at risk. I mean, America truly becomes a dead society when that has proceeded far and long enough. And we may not be too far from that point today, which is why the work you're doing is so refreshing and so hopeful.
Well, we hope so, and we are not giving up. We plan to be here. We plan to continue to be as vocal and as visible as we can across the nation. And by the way, we have activists as well in Australia, India, Argentina, and Europe.
Well, of course,
wherever there is a jury that exists, juries always should be serving the same purpose: to protect other individuals from tyrannical, power-hungry government.
Wow. We have another caller, Theodora from Santa Cruz. Theodora, you're on the line.
Hi. I had a similar observation as Steve did, which is that if you're being, asked questions to be part of the jury, as soon as you make any mention that lets them know that you know about the rights of jurors, you will not be on that jury. And so I'm going to say something to your listeners that you may not feel free to say. And that is, play dumb. If you want to be on the jury, play dumb. Because if they know you know, you will not be on that jury. And when you go into the jury and start, if indeed it's a case where you feel the law is not justified and attacks the law, and I'm glad to hear you mention medical marijuana, because that's an issue I've worked on for 16 years, and I'm real glad Future's always been very supportive of that, and I thank them for that. But if you're on one of those cases where somebody is being unfairly persecuted in terms of constitutional rights, continue to play dumb. Continue to play dumb, but just, you know, hold your ground and say, I don't see it, I don't see it. But don't, you know, let on that you know anything, because they will get you disqualified very quickly.
That's an excellent point. Again, I just posted an essay on our website about that very thing. And I want to say something as well. When this country was founded, it was a well-understood and recognized condition of human existence that we own our bodies, we own our lives, and we own our minds. And what you choose to do with your body or anybody else, and how you choose to medicate it, whatever you choose to do, it's your responsibility. I hope everybody out there who's listening is taking exceptionally good care of their bodies. But they belong to us. If we do not own our bodies, if the government can tell us what to do with our bodies, what we can eat, what we can ingest, what kind of surgery we can have, whatever, then we no longer own our bodies, we no longer own our lives, and we are slaves.
Amen.
Thank you very much for calling,
Theodora. Thanks for the show, and thanks, Fiji, for the wonderful work they've been doing
many
years.
Hand out our literature and tell everybody you know.
I will.
You called in.
Okay.
Keep up the good work.
This is ripe grounds here in Santa Cruz.
Because, that's good.
our government is big and getting bigger by the day, and our Justice Department is not serving to the kind of principles that Fija speaks to. We have another caller, Ted from Spokane. Ted, what's your comment or question?
Hello. Now, I wasn't able to hear the whole show, but I wonder if the subject of Judge Roy Moore has come up. I know that the law was on his side, and it was very plain that it was on his side, but the popular opinion of the day was against him, and they actually took his position. I think he was Attorney General, wasn't he? Yet the law, I don't think anyone would really argue, was on the judge's side. So I'd like to hear that discussed, if I may. And this is a wonderful program, and thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you for calling. Do you have any comments?
I'm sorry, Michael. I actually couldn't hear him, so if you'd please paraphrase what he said, I'd be happy to comment on it.
Well, he was asking about Roy Moore, who, as I recall, was a Supreme Court justice in Alabama who lost his office. And the caller was questioning about his a court case where the law was on his side, and according to the caller, and wanted to understand how the process in this context all worked to harm Roy Moore.
Okay. That was an interesting case, and that had to do with, I believe, the Ten Commandments being displayed either in the courtroom or somewhere else. There was no jury trial that I know of in this case, and we are the Fully Informed Jury Association. I don't see anything wrong with it. Personally, I don't see anything wrong with the expression Judge Moore wanted to have in his courtroom, since those things are carved in the Supreme Court building as well, and they are the basis of a lot of common, if not all common law, in Western civilization. And are the same laws, by the way, in most religions I have studied. However, there was no jury trial, so there was no opportunity for a jury to nullify anything. And so for me to speak to it at this time would kind of be a non sequitur for what we're talking about.
Okay. What do you see for Fija over the next few years?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we are developing some focus brochures. We're just finishing up on how juries protect the Second Amendment rights of gun owners. We are getting ready to work on one for homeschoolers. We're doing another one on medical marijuana, and maybe a couple other issues which we're still sorting out. So we're looking at some focus campaigns. We've been doing a lot of work in Florida, California, New York, and New Jersey. We've been doing a lot of street work in those states and a lot of speaking in those states, only because they're states with enough population and with enough problems that we need to inform the jurors and the jury pool in those states. I think in the next few years we're going to see this idea, this concept of how we defend our human rights spreading more internationally. We're already seeing it. I worked with the Japanese government somewhat when they were writing their new constitution on the role of the jury, and I speak on it fairly often, and we have other speakers as well. So I think we're going to see, as we see government trying to centralize and get more power away from the people and take more of our lives and the productivity of our labor and our rights, as they try to usurp those from us, I think we're going to see more people coming to understand what they can do when they serve on a jury. What concerns me is that so many people are afraid to ask for a jury trial because they're told if they do, then they will get the baddest sentence available, that they will take a plea bargain even if they are absolutely innocent. So we also are working to counteract that. And again, we're doing that by educating people. You know, if you are going to be a defendant, make sure you ask for a jury trial. Make sure people in your community are educating the jury pool that they can just say no.
Well, that's an important issue here in Santa Cruz. I know a judge just recently ruled, contrary to his expressed ruling in the courtroom, his opinion changed his position, and he's ruled that very massive fines can be administered administratively by the local planning department.
Yeah.
And that violates the Seventh Amendment. And the jury nullification becomes a difficult process when the jury can't even get to the issue that that is undermining the constitutional framework of this country.
Yes, exactly, because the jury has been, they found these loopholes to leave the jury out, so the jury cannot offer fellow citizens protection. And we must keep demanding jury trials and write essays. Take anything off our website, it's not copyrighted. Take any part of it, use it as a letter to your editor, take phrases, take paragraphs, whatever you need, put pressure on them.
And that's
bring
how...
Bring it back to honesty and justice.
And that's how this audience, Freedom 21 Santa Cruz audience, can get involved and help to spread this very important word.
Let's give out our website and phone number one more time. I know we're getting close to the end of the show. Our website is www.fija, for Fully Informed Jury Association, www.fija.org. Call our toll-free number for a free information packet, 1-800-1800-835-5879, or to say that in letters, it's 1-800-TELJURY. That's Tell Jury with one L in Tell. Please become informed, become an informed potential juror, and inform everyone else you know. You will be protecting your own rights.
Well, and we'll be managing to salvage the prospective future of America, because things are falling, and we talk about those issues regularly at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and this is a very meaningful way to reconstruct the liberties that that are swiftly being lost in this country. An informed jury can do a whole lot to reverse that process, and I want to thank you very much for being our guest tonight. You're such a pleasant person to talk with.
Thank you.
I'm really saddened that the hour is over.
I can come back again maybe in 6 months or a year or sometime when we have other people listening, and I'd love to repeat this.
Well, wonderful. That will happen.
Michael, thank you so very much for your interest in justice and liberty in this country. I appreciate that you're there.
Well, I appreciate that you're there. And again, that...
Hello?
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, good evening, and welcome to the second hour of this week's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. My name is Michael Shaw, and this second hour we're going to talk about the return of sustainable transportation and the scam that that is to Santa Cruz. Now, if you're not in Santa Cruz, and of course most of our listenership is spread out to various stations and various other methods of listening, are not in Santa Cruz, the reason why you want to understand this is because Santa Cruz is a boilerplate for the whole sustainable movement that is swarming the United States. Tomorrow I'm going to be on a radio show in New Jersey where smart growth is the untrampled issue of the day, you know, where they show their smart growth plans with towns that exist today that over their 20-year plan for smart growth implementation, they'll simply disappear. You see, there's no regard for private property or individuality in the sustainable movement, and it's very deeply seated here in Santa Cruz. We've not heard too much from the sustainablers for the last few years. They've been down buried deep into the government buildings with one scheme after another. They bring some of these to the polls, and the good news is the voters have been turning down the sustainable schemes. But here they come again after being soundly defeated just 2 years ago with a sustainable, it was over $300 billion for a small county like Santa Cruz, a sustainable transportation scheme defeated horribly from their perspective at the polls. They needed 67% to win. They got 42%. But now the county treasurer is out doing the consensus process, setting up meetings in each supervisorial district around the county. And what we are doing tonight is we're bringing a local college student who attended a sustainable scam scheme meeting up at the local University of California at Santa Cruz today, a sparsely attended meeting where the Santa Cruz County tax collector, Fred Keeley, gave his scheme for a second bite at the sustainable transportation scam here in Santa Cruz. So our guest this hour is Wyatt Hall, a UCSC senior who was at that meeting today and is here tonight to tell us about it.
Good evening, Michael. Well, thank you for having me.
Well, welcome to you, and it's a pleasure for me to have Wyatt here and to be able to look at the guest eyeball to eyeball, something I don't get to do too often, and smile while we go through this show. Well, tell us what happened up on campus at UCSC today.
Absolutely, Michael. It's my pleasure. So, about on Friday, I got an email, an invitation to a workshop to work on transportation issues, specifically regarding the UCSC campus. So I was interested in that, and I took a look at the website, and if any of the listeners want to check it out right now, it's tftaskforce.org. And I'm a listener of the Freedom 21 radio program, and so I'm familiar with some of these sustainable scams. But what was interesting is that it was framed with some new language that I hadn't quite seen before. But it looked interesting, and it seemed to affect my community and the people that I work with at the university. So I thought I would go up and see what was going on. So I took a look at the website, and they said it was an easy option. You could either go online and input your personal ideas about transportation problems and solutions, and then also funding. Or if you didn't want to do it online, you could actually come to the meeting. So that's what I did, and it was yesterday at about 6:30 p.m., which I don't know what your preconceived notions of college students are, but, you know, most of them are waking up, you know, 5:30, 6:30 p.m. It's, you know, they're getting ready. So I was expecting, you know, there'd be a lot of my fellow students up there. It was up at the Stevenson Center, which is one of the colleges on campus. And I was greeted by Santa Cruz County Regional Transportation Commission delegate. She was very friendly, very warm, you know, greeted me, had me sign in and get a name tag. Then I was brought over to a table, and there were a few people just sort of milling about, and recognized the main man, Fred Keeley, who is a former assemblyman, and we'd actually met once before, back when I was in high school. And he was just sort of talking with a few people, and there were a few, I would say about 15, 20 people there. Most of them seemed to be weren't quite the college crowd. They seemed to be people who may be working at the university as faculty and such. So the Fred Keeley then started the meeting and invited everyone to kind of sit down at a table. And he sort of explained the process, and I'll step you through that and try to, hopefully paraphrase as best I can, you know, how he described the process and how I understood it. The Transportation Funding Task Force was an outgrowth of the Regional Transportation Commission, and he described it as it being a horizontal group instead of a vertically organized organization like the Regional Transportation Commission. And what he meant by horizontal was that everyone is on the same level. Everyone's input is equally valued. And so the Transportation Task Force is composed of members from around the county, and that the workshop was going to allow individual community members to be at that same level and bring their input to the workshop. So began, and then there was, one thing I was kind of curious just to going into this was what the end outcome was going to be from this workshop. And Fred Keeley, the quote-unquote convener, said that there really was no predetermined outcome from what they had planned, and that it was really just kind of a public opinion bringing input into it, and that from at that point he would then go in combining all of the ideas and the solutions that the public had brought to the table, and then would go into what he called his cave, and then write up the report, kind of summarizing that, and then those ideas would go to the Transportation Commission, and then from there another stage of workshops or public debate would then possibly occur.
Well, interesting. Why did he proclaim that this wasn't a predetermined outcome?
Well,
it sounds rather defensive, because that's the language we use to describe these consensus seances that are held from time to time around the county.
You know, my understanding of the no predetermined outcome, I think, probably stems from the public opinion about the process in which these organizations and bureaucracies seem to work through. And not having any predetermined outcome, at least from my perspective, seemed to be a great opportunity that I might actually have some real say in voicing my opinion about what I really thought were problems in transportation in Santa Cruz and in my area.
And how many students are at the university?
Approximate figures, I believe currently there are 12,000 undergraduate students studying at the university.
And how many were at this meeting to gather public consensus?
Students, there were maybe 10 at the most.
Okay.
There were a few kind of, you know, typical UCSC style. There were a few stragglers, you know, coming from classes if they couldn't get there right away. But
okay. For the listeners, I've come to understand, as a result of this information, that there are 5 scheduled meetings around the county, conducted by Fred Keeley, really run by through the Regional Transportation Commission, unelected body that makes a lot of policy in this county. 5, one for each supervisorial district. 2 of these meetings have been held. 3 are yet to go. There had been no advertisement of a meeting up at UCSC. My understanding is that these meetings may have 100 people or so, most of whom are connected with the Regional Transportation Commission, that there are not too many citizens. So you've got 12,000 students up at UCSC, each one of them in their own way, I'm sure, concerned about transportation. And you had a dozen or fewer students attending this meeting, where the outcome has not been determined by the bureaucrats with their plans, but is being developed based upon the inputs of very sparse attendance from citizens. And after all, students have something besides attending these kinds of meetings at 6:30 at night, just as moms and dads have something else to do in the evening or on Saturday than to watch a consensus process unfold in their neighborhood. But take us from there and tell us what the plans from the Regional Transportation Commission and the county's tax collector, Fred Keeley, are all about.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate assessment, Michael, about the member groups who seem to populate these meetings. After a general introduction, there were a couple of guidelines that were sort of set forth, and if you don't mind right now, I'll just kind of read through a couple of them, because I think the wording and sort of the framing of it is pretty interesting.
Do that, please.
The first one is good faith, and also point out that these guidelines were also posted on up on framed pieces of paper that were up, but they were kind of in the background, but they were there to kind of, you know, remind the people, the participants, of what these guidelines were. The first is good faith, and it reads as, "It is critically important that each and every person participating in the transportation funding task force process be there in good faith. This means that while advocacy, strong points of view, values and principles are all respected, each and every person deserves to have their point of view, values, and principles respected as well. Secondly, good faith participation means that you will be there to help identify problems and solve them." That on its own seemed to be kind of the basic gist of things. Yeah, we were there. We were invited to identify these problems and, you know, provide our own opinions for what the solutions to those problems might be. The second guideline was civility. "Ours is a community with many points of view and people with passion about their points of view. We encourage passion and strength of conviction, but it must be presented in a civil and constructive manner. It is expected that people will participate orally and in writing, exhibiting the highest standards of civil discourse." And the third, and this is the one that's the most interesting.
Can I ask what the highest level of civil discourse meant?
Well, you know,
is that defined?
No, it's not. Although I think, especially coming from an academic setting where most students are expected to not shout, you know, out or, you know, bring large dissent to their professors or anyone else in authority, I think that that means that you're there to, you know, be civil and not, you know, shout or
profanities
or, you know, bring about, if you really disagree with someone, not to attack them personally, but to simply just sort of be there bringing ideas and let the ideas speak for themselves.
Okay.
The third guideline is the one that I've been the most perplexed by, and I'm hoping, Michael, maybe that, you know, in our discussion we can talk about this some more. So the difference between principled compromise versus compromising principles. "No one will ever be asked to compromise the principles at any point in this process, but everyone is being asked now to acknowledge that we all are working toward a principled compromise. In other words, no one will be asked to accept something that violates their core values, while, at the same time, everyone is being asked to listen and understand other points of view and needs in the community and actively seek common ground."
My. Well, principled compromise is an oxymoron if I ever heard of one. Now, we can all compromise the price of what it is we're selling.
Absolutely.
But strikes me that if you have a child going out on a date, and your last words to them were, "Now, I don't want any of your, I want all of your principles to be subject to some compromise." I think your son or daughter would catch on pretty quickly to the nonsense that a parent giving a child that kind of instruction. I don't understand the term principled compromise. You know, to compromise your principle as being something of value. If your principle is predicated upon a set of ideals, you know, if we're going to compromise those ideals, your principles are gone. you know, principles and compromise are two different, they sit on two different planes. So I suppose my reaction would be that if we're to act in good faith and with civility and to be principled in our compromises, that all of that adds up to something of a stifling intellectual framework that is designed to take and develop that preordained outcome. You've taken the roadblocks from a preordained outcome and firmly implanted them on the road if you take those three concepts. Deal in good faith, be civil, and compromise, be principled in your compromise.
Right, right. It seems to take away the arbitration of these ideas and seems to displace them and put them someplace else, somewhere else down the road in the process. So if we can continue talking about the actual process and experience of being, you know, a participant in the workshop, the transportation issues are divided into three groups. First is identifying problems, then solutions, and then finding funding for those solutions. At the workshop itself, there were at first two tables because it was fairly small, and at each table there were about between probably 7 to 10 people, and there were at my table there were a number of members of the administrative community from UCSC, and then also a few members from the Santa Cruz City, and they within each group supposedly there was a sort of unofficial leader who is sort of self-appointed within the group, and then also a sort of like a note taker or a secretary who would record and then report back what each group found in their sort of discovery and conversation. So in the first step, we were talking about the problems, and within each one of these breakout sessions, the problems were actually divided up into three separate questions, the first of which was, what are the issues in your specific neighborhood? So we went around and talked about the issues. Okay, one of the kind of general things that came up was that the road conditions are bad, and so that they should be fixed. Then also issues about, you know, more public transportation, noise in the street. You know, it seemed to vary a lot. There was a diverse set of groups. But what was interesting in the way in which they broke it up is that you had to start thinking about your neighborhood. Then the next step was, what are the problems in your community, and then further out to the region. So in the course of the first conversation over 10-15 minutes, you know, each person had an opportunity to kind of raise their issues. But as the conversation progressed, it seemed to grow farther and farther away from personal issues and more towards larger schemes. And I was a little confused about this at first because I thought we were going to be focusing mainly on UCSC transportation issues. Some of those came up, but the conversation seemed to be geared and oriented more towards these larger issues that needed very kind of complicated or serious amounts of funding, supposedly, to be solved. So at the end of the 15 or 20 minutes, the lists would then be compiled by the secretary, everyone who had gone around and added their input. Then the secretary would then present to the entire group and basically just listed off the ideas that were, and the problems that were addressed. Same process would then occur for the other groups. They would come up and list. There was no dialogue, no discussion. It was just sort of, you know, point by point, just kind of reiterating what had already been said in the group to the other tables. And very quickly it seemed to be apparent that there was a lot of consensus already being formed just based on the way in which the questions were structured. So the issues were very... many of the issues I'd heard before, you know, metro transportation needs more funding, the roads are in disrepair, Highway 1 needs to be widened, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, all of that is interesting. Did you find that that there were ideas that some came up with that didn't get into this master sheet?
Well, there were... some of the ideas seemed to be a little off topic at times, or they were relegated to different positions. Like, for example, when we were talking about the problems themselves, they oftentimes whoever was presenting the idea would kind of jump immediately to the solutions, and so that was sort of fragmented away from the kind of the discussion that was taking place.
Okay, because what I've seen typically in these consensus seances is that if an individual's suggestion isn't along the goals of the preordained end, that it simply doesn't end up on the final summary sheet of what was suggested by members of the audience, which makes it very frustrated for those people who are not for this grab bag transportation plan that comes down to bicycles and bike paths and other things when you're sitting with a freeway that doesn't move in the afternoon because it's so jammed and so outdated with its smallness. And clearly here in Santa Cruz and in many places around this state, and I'm sure around the country, there is such a lobby that's been built against auto use that you find here in Santa Cruz the rejected bill from several years ago was heavily funding bicycle and walking trails. And had a 17-year program for the build-out of one additional carpool lane on about 15 miles of freeway through the county. And so the voters heavily turned that down. Only 42% voted for that bill. It needed 67% to pass. What was interesting is that if we look at the larger Central California area, including the whole San Francisco Bay region, there were eight other counties that had similar funding mechanisms. I know up in Alameda County, the funding mechanism was a $2 billion bond. It passed. All other eight counties passed it, and now they're stuck with a lot of bicycle lanes. And I know in Alameda there was a plan. They were going to spend $150,000 to study the needed expansion of the Caldecott Tunnel, which linked one side of the county to the other. But that was $150,000 out of $2 billion simply to study the expansion, whereas roughly half $1 billion was to go to bicycle trails. I don't think the voters understood what they were voting for in these eight other counties, all of which passed these sustainable transportation proposals. But here in Santa Cruz, the king of sustainable development in this region and maybe in a much wider area, it was defeated soundly. And so what's curious is how after a two-year hiatus, this regional transportation committee, again made up of unelected people, insiders with a bottom line bent, they come up now with these consensus meetings, which are sparsely attended except by their own paid advocates by county members, and they're coming at it again with massive funding for bicycles, etc., and a two-lane freeway that is just stuck in the afternoon and in the morning, and no real proposals for changing that. Fred Keeley, I know, was on another radio station just a day or two ago, and some very sweet, wise woman called in and said, why don't you just have a bond measure first for widening the freeway? You can have another one for bicycle lanes and another one for more buses and for the train system, but it's when you mix them all together that you end up with this kind of problem. And of course, what the sustainable developers here in the county have tried to do was 2 years ago come up with a $350 billion bond, $350 million bond, without really allocating between this and that how the money was to be spent. The idea for road improvements was to be a 17-year constant construction of Highway 1. So this thing was turned down. Of course, people said, well, people don't want to widen the highway, and that's why they turned it down, but people want the bike trails, and they want the buses, and they want this expensive rail line, was the response the sustainable crowd gave to the community, including our newspaper, a subsidiary of the Dow Jones group. So we're still struggling with this. The wise citizens of this county, at some level, it seems to me, have got their heads above water. You know, they can smell a funny deal when it comes along, and they reject it. But it's interesting how it's been reshaped to come into, electoral district one at a time with this program for a consensus process by which we'll come up with some good ideas. I mean, there's no new idea that I've heard in these discussions. They're all the same old ideas, and what we need is some leadership that says, we're going to raise some money, get the highway, state highway widened, mostly with state funds, and we're going to start to widen the highway. And then if we want to pass a $100 billion train bill, well, let's try to do that. You know, many wouldn't vote for that, but you know, it seems to me that we've got to separate these different ideas and go one by one, so we know where the money is going, we know what the time frame is, and there's some specific proposals along those lines. Was there any sentiment like that expressed in this meeting that you attended yesterday?
Well, at least at my table, there was certainly some back and forth between different members about many of those same issues, whether or not Measure J was designed to fail, or you know, many of the different questions about, you know, how to fund, you know, the widening project, which has been delayed so many times. And it seemed like that there were, at least at my table, there were many people who seemed to be fairly well informed about a lot of these issues, but yet still didn't seem to have necessarily the right idea about the solution to them. And that's, you know, at least that seems to be auspiciously why they were there, was to sort of, you know, find some answer to that. Now, one of the things that was also interesting, I found, was that there were a few comments. At least there was one gentleman at another table who said, you know, well, you know, in comparison to New York or L.A. or New Orleans, which was where he was from, you know, Santa Cruz actually doesn't really have much of a transportation issue, at least in comparison to those other cities. So I think it's interesting how there's, you know, it's a possibly, you know, it's a sort of a fixed problem in the sense that they're, you know, they're making it out to be a bigger, you know, that the funding issues are actually possibly more available than they really are, although I'm not necessarily an expert in those issues, but that's sort of my impression.
Do you have a sense about the concept of melding all of these transportation, and they're talking about walking, bike riding, buses, trains, and vehicular travel. Was there any sense that mixing all these together and going for transportation funding was somehow missing the focus that's needed to get something really done?
It seems to be that way, especially in the way in which the workshop was framed, in the way in which the problems and the solutions and then the final segment of the finding the funding, they were all disconnected but yet sort of kind of combined together. There was no really way in which we could, you know, any of our groups could really focus in on one of the particular issues. We just kind of had to keep moving along from problem to problem to solution to solution. And I think that does, and it represented, at least in my personal, in my experience of being there, I got very confused and felt like I needed more time to really focus in on some of these issues, or really kind of be able to step back and ask the question of, okay, why isn't, what has happened to all this funding that used to exist for the Highway 1 widening, or, you know, and, you know, simple, you know, pothole repair that has, you know, really left our county, especially with all the current, you know, the recent storms, you know, in a real vulnerable situation, especially for a lot of the residents who live out in the mountains and the countryside like I do.
Well, as I've seen, and I need to be more specific than I'm about to be, but the transportation funding dynamic for this county will leave the rural areas in a lurch. The whole because once you create sustainability as a prevailing concept, the idea, of course, is to bring all the people in and put them in, stack them and pack them buildings along a railroad track. Now, in this county, there's 10,000 units. That doesn't sound like a lot by big city standards, but we're not a big city, and you know, basically, development in this county is very constrained. But 10,000 government-controlled units along a railroad track that's not operational has been adopted, and it's being implemented as we talk. I know that in some of the projects, you're prohibited, if you're going to live there, from owning a car. So we can see clearly that machinations are being put upon us to squeeze us in, change our process of transportation, and change our process of job seeking. And it's so critical. That's why it's so critical for them to get these transportation funding, so that they can rearrange that system as they rearrange the rest of how society operates. Well, we have a caller, Gary from Capitola. Are you with us, Gary?
Yeah, good evening.
Well, good evening to you. And
yeah, this is all very familiar to me, and I've had an opportunity to attend two of those so-called task force situations for transportation, and also a fantastic experience with their so-called economic summit this last Saturday.
I've read about that in the newspaper. Tell us about the economic summit, Gary.
I'll just make a comment on your guest there. During the first transportation meeting, I had printed up a article called The Consensus Process, and also the techniques, consensus versus Robert's Rules orders. So I think that Fred Keeley is getting a little defensive in saying that this is not a predetermined situation, because he's well aware that it is.
Well, and why do you say that? I mean, we've certainly had shows here on consensus process, the work of Beverly Ekman. For those who want more information, you can go to our website and search for Beverly Ekman or the consensus process. You can look at her workbook called, you can look at the Beverly Ekman workbook, and the name is escaping me, at the website. And you'll gain a lot of information about how consensus works, how these screens that they put up in the front of the room, and everything must fit to this equilibrium. And it is all driven by definition. A consensus process is driven by an objective.
And yeah, it's very fascinating. If people really want to get into the depth of it and go back into the psychology of it, if they hit either Delphi technique or Tavistock, which is a a center built in like World War One in order to protect British soldiers from the shell shock and so forth. But it was picked up by the large internationals, and they use it for their own purposes now, the multinational corporations, etc. But back to this here locally, I've got the final draft of the United Nations Agenda 21 that was brought about in Santa Cruz County, and it was adopted, I guess, by the county, or at least the final draft here is dated 97, which is about 10 years ago. And they have a section in there called transportation. So all you have to do is go to this predetermined plan that was originated 10 years ago, and you'll find exactly what they're doing today.
Well, you know, let me just stop you for a second, Gary. I'm listed in that book as a collaborator. I did attend those meetings. I hardly collaborated, but and I've got it open right now, transportation, and you will find the policies being pursued by Santa Cruz elected officials, as well as these unelected bureaucracies like the Regional Transportation Commission, are following this plan almost to the T.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's a letter that introduces the Agenda 21, and it's signed by our local congressman, Sam Farr, who flies the United Nations flag. At least he doesn't hide his intentions. But if you'll look at the lower left-hand corner, the person that typed that particular letter, the letters are DB, which is Donna Blitzer. Donna Blitzer was an assistant to Sam Farr. She now works up at UCSC.
Yes, she was actually at my table.
Exactly, and she was at my table. She was at my table at the transportation meeting in Live Oak, and they had recruited. People were like Mr. Shaw there that were invited and brought in, and not particularly knowing what's going on. And I said, I complained about the process at my table as it started off, because I was familiar with it. And the lady said she'd never heard of Agenda 21, and I looked across at Donna Blitzer. I said, but Donna could tell you something about this, and she remained as silent as a tomb.
Well, what's interesting, and I'll say this as somebody who participated in Agenda 21, is that their goal was that was to be the manna that everybody was to search out and just grab onto, and that was by today, that was going to be the the blessing that everyone looked up to, you know, and yet bring up Agenda 21 to the people who were responsible for it, and they run for cover. So it hasn't worked as they wanted it to work, and that's why they struggle with elections and all kinds of phony financing schemes and have to come back again with these consensus processes. It's not working.
They're designed to trick the people, and they had a big defeat with Measure J. And, of course, in looking, reading right up from this Agenda 21 10 years ago, it says cars are not sustainable as a mode of transportation, that a bus system must be subsidized. They're not subsidized enough. That they have to shift from funding highways, that they have to enact legislation to put more expenses on the car driver, and they have to decrease the use of the automobile. And then also that the county and city have to encourage mixed use, and that's exactly what they're doing with these new the new version of Agenda 21 under these new titles. Now also the meeting that I attended on Saturday, which was called an economic summit, on the brochure, I'm looking at the brochure right now, and it's the planning committee includes Donna Blitzer. So here we've got reports from the man you've got on there right now. I was at a table on the first transportation thing, and here is this economic summit. So she's certainly a very well paid or very dedicated individual. Also, the people that were on the panel that delivered this economic summit included Celia Scott, Tony Hill, other people whose name is in the back of Agenda 21 of 10 years ago. So it is the same program. I believe that they violated the Brown Act, if not the spirit of the Brown Act. They had a quorum of four people from the city of Santa Cruz there making policy, including a city assistant city manager, which I think should violate ethics. If it doesn't, he's supposed to be taking orders from our elected representatives. He's not supposed to be giving orders or creating policy. I took notes from everybody on the panel, and I've got stories to tell at the table, but I don't want to monopolize the time. But from the six people on the panel, here are the words. And
when you say panel, let's just pause for a minute. Panel is the process by which you break down into tables that are controlled by an insider to the process. And each panel then comes up with their ideas, guided and supervised by the two or three insiders who are at every table, where genuinely free and independent ideas are squashed one way or another. It is a process for delivering to the broader room a sheet of paper that basically looks like everybody else's sheet of paper. Now, that's consensus. It's the process of getting to a predetermined outcome, and there's plenty of writings on that. Go to our website at freedom21santacruz.net, and you'll find plenty there on the Delphi technique and consensus process generally. And I just want to branch off for a minute before you go back to that story, because people in other areas don't have a local Agenda 21 program. Sustainable Community Action Plan, our agenda for the 21st century, says their cover page. But that's only because they don't call it Agenda 21.
They might call it smart growth, localism. They've got so many different words to disguise this thing.
Well, they call it Monterey, the county to the south of us. They call it Common Ground. And there are a lot of other innocuous, warm and fuzzy terms that are used around this state and around the country. There is no county in the United States that is not infiltrated with Agenda 21 policies, the reshaping of America to fit as merely a colony of a new world order. And that's what it's about. They need to get us out of our cars. They need to crush the middle class. And if you look around, you can see this happening from a thousand points of darkness, is to take off on the George Bush first concept in this regard. But let's go back to that table you were talking about, the table of six people at the economic summit at Santa Cruz.
Right. I think another thing, even before I go into that, that's important, the very process itself, and they themselves talk about the process, and I brought that up at my table, but the process itself is un-American. Even though it sounds healthy and wholesome, what they're doing is they're creating policy deliberately outside of the city hall and the county governments, and that's where there is no constitution that governs it, there's no statutory law that governs it, and that they are able to make policy. They're in effect creating Soviets or stakeholders. They have a thousand different names, but what they're doing is they're creating a gaggle of people to create the appearance of popular support to put over programs that fit into the New World Order of the United Nations. The Agenda 21 here, again, was funded by the United Nations associations from New Haven to San Francisco to Santa Cruz.
Well, that may sound like a jump to new listeners in the show, but Agenda 21 is the program that was announced by the United Nations at the Earth Summit held in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. So there's no question that, you know, there's a lot of great material on our website and leading to other websites. The Agenda 21ers themselves would not deny that its basis and origin and thought is a United Nations program for a global to local New World Order.
Right. The final report I have here says it's published by the United Nations Association of Santa Cruz, September 1997. So, their hand is more than well dipped in it. Anyway, some of the people that were on the front panel before they initiated the whole thing, they tried to set up a tone for the whole event. It was a six-hour event this time for the economic summit, a little bit longer than the transportation ones, and they had literally a free lunch for the people that participated. Here's some of the words that people can be aware of. The city manager talked about sustainable and process, etc. The person from the Chamber of Commerce, of course, talked about business-government partnerships, which is nothing more than Mussolini's fascism.
Well, sir, let's pause for a second there, because listeners from around the country are going to say, well, Chamber of Commerce, that certainly can't be impugned this way. It needs to be known by listeners that while most members of Chamber of Commerce are simply there for networking, their business with other businesses and all working to generate customers, the national and international Chamber of Commerce's are highly committed as NGOs, non-governmental organizations, signed to and committed to the principles of the United Nations, which call for the end of national sovereignty, basically. So be wary, particularly here in Santa Cruz County, of the local chambers of commerce. The legendary figures that have flown through the various local chambers are incredible indeed, both in their training and what they've done here and where they've moved off to do it other places. Many people may still look at Santa Cruz and say, oh, that's just a strange place, a beautiful place, but, man, strange place. Santa Cruz is not, fill in the blank. The problem is what I'm really sorry to have to say is that as I travel the country and travel through this state, what afflicts Santa Cruz is in every community of this country.
Yep, and you'll find a lot of the large businesses, in fact, supporting a lot of this, the sponsors for
the. Well, the economics of sustainable development is public-private partnership. That's pure Fabian socialist thought. It is where free enterprise and private property really no longer exist. If you are chosen as an operator by the government because you're meeting their goals of accumulating power, you might be able to be the champion of this business or that business, and you might even be told that you own it. But that's just until and only for so long as you're serving the government interests.
Some of the other ones, I'll just do the... some of the words: economic justice, sustainability, sustain what we have, partnerships, interdependence was one of them, a declaration of interdependence. One of the guys that was part of the Agenda 21 10 years ago, he looked like he didn't want to be there. But he says he's heard it all before, and he was kind of he must have been called to show up because he wasn't particularly enthusiastic. And then the last one was almost, well, there was two of them that were kind of hilarious, calling for rent control, and said that they didn't like the word sustainability but used it continually, talked about an interdependent community, and declared quite, you know, fervently that economics is a social science. We get to decide, was the statement. And,
well, that's the public-private partnership, and the interdependence is the undoing of America and the Declaration of Independence. And that's happening in the schools, too. As I've been hearing that terminology around here for at least 10 years, and the first place and the place I've heard it the most is in the from the mouths of the school leaders.
Right. Well, you know, the economics of social science is the three banes of the last century that killed so many people with the, you know, fascism and Nazism and Soviet Union. But this particular panel person sat down, and before she sat down, she said, peak oil, peak oil, peak oil, three times like a rooster, and it, you know, it was almost hilarious. And they had one other person on the panel that's working actually at UCSC, and she's been working for obviously the government for eight some years, and she had an interpreter there because she doesn't speak a word of English after 8 years, and what she wanted was subsidized affordable housing. She just thought it was unfair for her to have to live, you know, for what little pay the government pays her, but it was quite an interesting deal. The other thing is that it was broken into three groups, pretty much like your guest said, and they provided 14 to 15 questions on each page, and it was amazing that myself or one or two other independent people could really grab the steering wheel from them and move people from their nonsense. Nowhere in the 15 or 45 some set up questions in which you're supposed to make comments on was there any portion for providing for the infrastructure, nor was there for providing health codes, which would bring more tourists, you know, make sure you have clean restaurants and the restrooms are, you know, fine. We have a problem with that in our community. We've got a problem with the condoms and needles in the recreation areas and parks. Law enforcement, code enforcement, getting rid of the shopping thieves and the drug addicts in the, you know, downtown Santa Cruz would certainly help the local businesses and bring in businesses to fill up some of those vacancies down there. But none of that was addressed. The other thing that they didn't address at an economic summit in this area, which has so many farms, was illegal aliens. And of course, close to half of our jails are filled up with illegal aliens. They come in and they undercut the wages. They fill up the hospitals. They fill up the jails. They raise the cost of insurance because they're driving around without insurance. I mean, the thing just goes on and on. But this was not part of the Agenda 21 designed discussion because it doesn't fit in with their, you know, New World Order plans. In fact, that, you know, to address that would make it a problem. But merely by mentioning that at one or two of the tables that I happened to attend seemed to, you know, mess up their goals. Although the problem is that, like your guest said, there's somebody there writing what writing down what the input is. So it's another source of control. Not only do they declare the topic, but they screen what gets reported, and then it goes into the big pool to be, you know, taken in a back room where the original people who brought up the program pound out what they originally had in mind anyway. So it gets lost in the din.
Well, the din gets louder and louder, and I think the Agenda 21 process here is getting more and more desperate. But of course, it's coming to us not just from our local government. It's coming to us through Schwarzenegger and his plan for reordering California without counties and with consolidated school districts, 10 school districts for the entire state. It's coming to us from Washington, D.C., with the Bush regime and the funding for all of this stuff that comes from the federal government. It is a concerted effort across the board with our government, and yet it's not yet taking hold. Now, I'm not saying it's time to relax, that things are going well, because all the power sits in the Agenda 21 forces. The Democrat Party, the Republican Party, just as thoroughly as the Democrat Party, is fully entrenched in the creation of what you're calling the New World Order. I wouldn't disagree with that.
One of the other ways that they stack the deck is, they pre-selected for the whole county 100, basically around 100 people in order to be on the task force. And a lot of it's, most of it's the hardcore, and then they flatter, some other people by bringing them in there. And, of course, if a person's not aware of it, certainly they'd want to join and participate. But on the transportation task force, the first meeting I went to, I counted the tables, and there were 17 tables, and they had about 102 people, six at a table. And when you consider there's 100 on the task force, that didn't leave too many people that can participate. Also, when I arrived, they had the task force members in a separate room giving them a second or third instructions. So they indoctrinate before they indoctrinate. Then they spread them out among the tables. And then when they fill out the polling material or the suggestions, the people, it's at least 2-1 in that situation. Also, when I attended the second Transportation Task Force meeting, they instructed the facilitators or the people that went from meeting to meeting to fill out again what they thought, because he thought it might develop and change a little bit and it would be worthwhile to make those changes in there. What they're trying to do is to stuff the ballot box because there's so few participants. So in that first meeting, there couldn't have been more than 50 people out of the whole community. The second one, I think there might have been 30. If we average them out, you put it the high number. There might be 250 Joe Blows out there that might participate in this out of a county of, I don't know how many, hundreds of thousands.
250,000, roughly.
So they're going to come out like I've seen before in other cities, because we've had so much input, there can be no question that we do, and then they'll fill out their blank, not yours.
Well, the process is on. These consensus little seances were happening heavily in the year 2000 in this county, and Freedom 21 formed, and a number of us were hip to this right away, and this kind of planning all went below ground, and so we've been, some might say, ghost fighting here for the last 4 years. But today, these consensus and sustainability councils are popping out all over the county. They've covered most of the neighborhoods with their little neighborhood consensus process, little neighborhood consensus process. The process was defeated soundly in La Selva Beach and apparently in Corralitos. But most counties were, we observed some of them so that we knew what they were doing. Let it proceed. If you live in Bonnie Doon or Santa Cruz or Pleasure Point or Capitola, the consensus processed sustainable programs have been adopted, and now they're looking at it on a much broader and grander way. They've made their water policies advance substantially. Their transportation plans have been foiled, but at the same time, the citizens' interest in effective transportation has been foiled, so that's been a standoff. And now they're coming out to solicit the people for a broader commitment to the sustainable program. And if you have been listening to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and you've been waiting your time and sitting quietly, now's the time to come forward. You know, the one thing I think that we have done is made it not a criminal offense to speak out.
Michael, so, I have a suggestion. I've heard other people say don't participate or boycott, et cetera, but what do you think of, because they have so few people in the final analysis, is to go ahead and document what's going on in there. And if you set yourself up a little ad hoc committee or name and then go out to counter it's easy to match the number of polling suggestions they have, and have one based on free enterprise and basic city, you know, things that need to be taken care of versus the, you know, their planned program. But I think it can be countered. I think you need to know enough what's going on there. You need to have enough material in your hand to, you know, prove what happened in front of you, and don't be ashamed to speak up, because every time I have, you gather a few people, and you have people at least beginning, perhaps, to think. You know, these guys are having a hard time because they're, you know, what they're doing versus the truth and their organization behind it, which is, it's exposable. I mean, they can't deny their connections, and their, and certainly the technique is, un-American, and I think disgusting once people recognize it.
Well, if you're out there in the audience and you have a way to work into an organized forum to expose this dynamic, do that. If you want to work on your own to expose it, do that. If you want to call Freedom 21 Santa Cruz and say, hey, I'm here to join up, give us a call at 684-2232. And if you're, like most of our listeners, outside of Santa Cruz, just know that while you may not be as far along in your community, it may also be more underground in your community. It is in your community. Sustainable development is not going to go away without a conscious and concerted effort by the American people to preserve a life that holds for liberty and enables our children, all of our children.
Now, the third tier in each one of these sessions is, after you've looked at the problem, you offer the solutions, the next one is how to fund it. And I'll tell you, here's just a small list. Toll roads, user fees, sales tax, local gas tax, rental car tax, increased fines, parking fees to pay for structures, sin tax, more federal and state support, which means taxing yourself, French fry tax, fast food tax, luxury tax, statewide. I mean, it just goes on.
So these are the suggestions from the consensus committee makers who came to the call for the economic summit or for the transportation program. Is that what you're telling us?
Yep. This is it's hilarious to watch it. You know, go there with to be entertained in addition to, you know, informed.
It's tough for the average American to leave their family and put up with some of these things. But if we don't, the world has been changing for a good while, and now a final hard push is coming our way, and you can combine the effects of our last hour talking about jury nullification or the lack thereof in this country with the sustainable movement generally, and you can see that our children don't stand to live the life of freedom, mobility, and upwardness, and self-determination, because the new message is that we're all interdependent, and you do what you're told, or you won't get your bowl of soup. Gary, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate that information, and I'm sure our audience does as well. And Wyatt, do you have anything that you want to wrap the show up with?
Well, if anyone out there was listening and are interested in also possibly participating in going out to the upcoming transportation meetings, there's one in Watsonville on May 20th at Watsonville High School. That's at 1:30 p.m. There's one in Aptos on May 25th. That's a Thursday. That's at 6:30 p.m. at the Seacliff Best Western Inn. And then one on Wednesday, June 7th. That's in Santa Cruz at Mission Hill Middle School.
Okay. And if you want general information, check out our website, freedom21santacruz.net. And if you want to get involved, just do it. And that's another edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. And join us again next week. And until then, have a good week. Good night.